This is NBC Nightly News, Monday, April 23rd, reported by John Chancellor.
Good evening. On the program tonight, we'll be looking into more developments in the Watergate story, which is quickly becoming a grave crisis for the president. We'll also hear from Henry Kissinger, see some fighting in Indochina, check on wheat crops in Russia, and have a special report on Jonathan Livingston Seagull. First, Watergate. The Associated Press quotes Senate sources today as saying the White House mounted an elaborate cover-up operation in the Watergate affair designed to shield some of the highest-ranking officials of the Nixon administration. The AP says there is evidence that the president's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, was involved, along with John Ehrlichman of the White House. The story says that White House officials tried to pressure the FBI and the Justice Department to go slow in the Watergate investigation, that Attorney General Richard Kleindienst himself asked a federal prosecutor to go slow. The Justice Department vigorously denied that this evening. According to the AP, the Senate sources say there will be more resignations from the White House staff. The sources say the president himself may not have known about the Watergate bugging until after the police arrested seven men. But the sources say there is no question that the president knew of the cover-up operation, which may be the most damning accusation of all. John Mitchell resigned as campaign manager 2 weeks after the arrest at the Watergate, and at the time, Mitchell said he was quitting to spend more time with his wife and family. Paul Duke of our staff has learned that was not true. There was another reason.
Government investigator tells NBC News that Mitchell stepped down as director of the Republican campaign last July because he feared the Watergate case would blow up and prove to be an embarrassment to President Nixon. The source, who's been close to Watergate developments, says Mitchell told the president this when he resigned 2 weeks after Watergate broke. Mitchell calls the report absolutely untrue. At the time of his departure, there were stories that Martha Mitchell had given her husband an ultimatum to get out of politics or she would leave him. Mitchell's resignation announcement said he was leaving to devote more time to his wife and family. The NBC informant now says the real reason was Watergate. And the president knew it. Paul Duke, NBC News, Washington.
It now seems almost certain that there will be more indictments in the Watergate case. There is considerable speculation, some of it by administration officials, that there'll be a full-scale shakeup of the White House staff. There was talk of this at the president's retreat in Florida and a torrent of talk in Washington. Here are two reports.
No matter what else comes out of the Watergate investigation, the Nixon White House already is in administrative shambles because of it. The White House is a house divided. The operating rule for staff members is every man for himself. Jobs, careers, reputations, and in some cases, the possibility of imprisonment. All these things are involved. And the infighting has become so vicious that one inside source described this past Easter weekend as the weekend of the long knives. The current Washington assumption is that because of Watergate, most of the current White House staff is going to have to be replaced. Already there's speculation that Secretary of State William Rogers, an old personal friend of the president, has been given the job of recruiting a new staff. And there's also further talk that Melvin Laird, former Secretary of Defense, may be asked to become the new White House Chief of Staff. One thing is certain, the present White House staff, the group of men the president chose to help him run this country, that staff is no longer functioning. The White House is at a near standstill today because staff members are in their offices, silent, frightened, waiting to see what is going to happen next. Douglas Kiker, NBC News at the White House.
When the White House has nothing to say, the number two spokesman, Gerald Warren, is usually sent out to say it. Today, he was sent out to say nothing about Watergate. Warren did report that Mr. Nixon had talked by telephone with various staff members, but the only one he would identify was Foreign Affairs Advisor Henry Kissinger. Warren would not say if the president has met with John J. Wilson, the attorney retained by top presidential aides John Ehrlichman and H.R. Bob Haldeman. Contrary to custom, neither Ehrlichman nor Haldeman is here. News Secretary Ron Ziegler is here. But Warren said Ziegler was not briefing newsmen today because he was doing various chores for the president. That immediately raised speculation that Ziegler might be under consideration for the job of White House Chief of Staff if Haldeman were to resign. But Warren insisted that Ziegler was asked to do the chores because he is the senior staff member present. Finally, Warren was asked about the latest Washington Post story, saying that President Nixon had been warned by members of his own staff as early as last December that presidential aides were deeply involved in the Watergate case. Warren did not deny it. Richard Valeriani, NBC News, with the president in Florida.
And while the possibility of disgrace or criminal prosecution grew for members of the president's official staff, it was also learned that his personal lawyer, Californian Herbert Kalmbach, was given at least $200,000 in a special fund, some of which was used for political espionage and sabotage. These disclosures may continue to appear. The focus of much of the action these days is at the federal courthouse in Washington, and Gordon Graham reports from there.
For newsmen covering the Watergate story, it's mostly a waiting game, and today was no exception. Reporters waited at the federal courthouse for the expected grand jury appearance of White House counsel John Dean. But even without star witnesses, the court is busy every day with Watergate. Today, lawyers for the committee to re-elect the president turned over records demanded in one of several civil suits growing out of the Watergate affair. And James McCord, the man whose testimony reopened the whole Watergate mess, was in court for a minor legal matter. He reflected on his role in what had happened.
Well, I tried to give the information as best I knew it, to the best of my recollection, and as truthfully as I knew how. I'm glad that what appears to be verification is coming out of that. It was as accurate as I knew it to be, as I could recall it.
Have you told everything you know?
I really can't comment any further on what I've said to the grand jury or the Senate Watergate Committee, and wouldn't until they finish all of their interviews.
Tomorrow, the waiting begins again for John Dean and others. Gordon Graham, NBC News, Washington.
The events and disclosures and accusations of the past few days have changed the nature of the Watergate story, made it more important, and made it more of a problem for the president. At the beginning, the case dealt with an almost comic burglary. It developed into a serious affair of illegal espionage, and now it involves the most serious questions of obstruction of justice by officials at the highest level.
Well, Susie, how's the new job?
Unreal, Mr. Simmons. My first customer, and she can't make up her mind about a laxative. There's zillions.
Why not recommend the kind I use? Phillips Milk of Magnesia. It's so gentle and yet thorough. And Milk of Magnesia is the laxative doctors recommend most often.
Doctors do?
Sure do.
Well, Mrs. Drummond, I'd recommend Phillips Milk of Magnesia because it's the kind of laxative doctors recommend most.
Doctors do?
It's coming. A new European car, rally equipped with oversized steel-belted radials, sport bucket seats, an Indy-type wheel, special colors and optional racing stripes. Introducing the Sports Bug by Volkswagen. It's being made only in a limited edition. So if you don't get this rare bug now, you can't get it later.
In Washington today, the State Department made a point of saying that North Vietnamese troops are still playing an important role in the fighting in Cambodia. There have been official indications that no identifiable North Vietnamese units are fighting in Cambodia, which could strengthen arguments that there is no legal basis for American operations there. But the State Department says Hanoi soldiers are giving combat support to the Cambodian insurgents. In Cambodia, another Mekong River convoy reached Phnom Penh with supplies, the fourth convoy in 2 weeks. There was scattered fighting, some of it near Hong Nu, where the Mekong River crosses from South Vietnam into Cambodia. Our correspondent, Bob Jones, was in Hong Nu recently when the North Vietnamese opened up with rocket fire. Here's his report.
The first rocket was a dud. The second was not. Half of the casualties were children. Children helped carry smaller children who had survived out of the building. Ong Nu is the military headquarters directing the fighting where the Mekong River crosses from South Vietnam into Cambodia. That is why the North Vietnamese are hitting it with rockets. Both sides seem to feel that military control of this zone is critical to its survival. There is no longer an ICCS team here. The Poles and Hungarians never showed up. The Canadians and Indonesians stayed a while, but moved out one day after a rocket landed in the front yard of their compound. Now there is warfare of the most savage kind, with bombing, shelling, and bunker-to-bunker hand combat, and rockets that land in the middle of civilian communities. Bob Jones, NBC News, Hong Nhu, South Vietnam.
Henry Kissinger, President Nixon's foreign affairs advisor, says it's a brutal fact that North Vietnam has systematically and cynically broken all the pledges it made in the ceasefire. Kissinger said that today in a New York speech, and here is more of what he said.
Now, I think it is fair to say that we have been very disappointed in the compliance by the North Vietnamese with the agreement. We have believed, and we said so publicly, that the end of the war in Vietnam should start a process of normalization in the relations between Hanoi and the United States. Yet it is a brutal fact that on the important clauses of the agreement, the commitment to withdraw from Cambodia and the commitment to withdraw from Laos, which was unconditional, the commitment not to introduce troops or supplies into South Vietnam, which was also unconditional, except through authorized checkpoints, the respect for the demilitarized zone on which we spent 4 weeks in Paris, that all of these have been systematically, I may say cynically, violated by the other side.
Anthony Russo, co-defendant with Daniel Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers trial, said today that two top generals in the Vietnam War may be called as prosecution witnesses. They are Earl Wheeler, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and William Westmoreland, former commander in Vietnam. The trial is now at the stage where rebuttal witnesses are being put on the stand. One of them, who worked on the Pentagon Papers, is serving the needs of both sides in the case, and Frank Burkholder has that story.
The prosecution brought Leslie Gelbaut from Washington to be one of its chief rebuttal witnesses. But what he said was so intriguing to the defense that they've taken him over and made him a defense witness.
Gelb became director of the Pentagon Papers Task Force when then-Secretary of Defense McNamara set it up in 1967. Prosecutor David Nissen had him testify about a conversation in 1969 with defendant Daniel Ellsberg, during which Ellsberg suggested the Pentagon Papers ought to be made public. What Gelb didn't tell the prosecutor, but did tell defense counsel Charles Nissen, was that even before that conversation, he had himself urged McNamara to make the papers available to researchers and historians. He also described the process by which the Pentagon Papers came to be classified top secret sensitive. The typists, he said, finishing the first volumes of the study, asked what they should put down. He called a quick conference with two other officials, after which he decided on top secret. The subject was never considered again. He had never, he said, read any government instructions on how to decide about classification. The nearest thing he could remember was a film he was required to see entitled Beware of Blondes Who Are Excessively Friendly, They May Be Russian Spies. Frank Burkholder, NBC News, Los Angeles.
Crawling bug problems are always tough. But for the tougher ones, you need a professional strength bug killer. Now you can get one.
In a can. New Professional Strength Raid Ant and Roach Killer. It's got the identical tough bug-killing ingredient lots of professionals use. So when the bugs get tough with the bugs. Get new Professional Strength Raid Ant and Roach Killer. It's professional strength bug protection in a can.
A week ago, we damp mopped this half of the floor with this mop and shine product. And this half with Johnson's new step saver with self-stripping action. I'll add black heel marks, a tough floor care problem. Now, a new coat of both products With self-stripping Step Saver, the new coat dissolves the old, loosens the dirt, even the black heel marks. Self-stripping Step Saver cleans deep, shines bright, ends buildup.
Look, when it comes to central air conditioners, I've seen them all, even the round ones. Out here, there's one name that really draws them in, Lennox. Look at this crowd. The Lennox people have been around 80 years. They make real fine central air conditioners you just add to your forced air furnace. Or get the Works, a Lennox nifty weather machine that also warms, humidifies, even cleans the air. Look for Lennox in the Yellow Pages.
I'd walk a mile for a Lennox.
Greyhound's got quite a youth movement going these days. Young people are finding Greyhound's a great, inexpensive way to get closer to our country. Along the way, they found that Greyhound's changed a lot, too. New terminals, new buses that are roomier and more comfortable, really easy to ride. You know what? Maybe they know something you don't.
Herbert Stein, the president's chief economic advisor, said today that the administration is studying the possibility of asking for some tax increases. The idea would be, Stein said, to keep demand down and thereby slow inflation. The Agriculture Department said today that the cost of feeding an average family went up 3.5% in the month of March. Part of that inflationary rise comes from demand and part from shortages created by bad weather. Onions, for example, are a victim of bad weather this spring. Lou Davis has the story.
At this time of year, onions are usually plentiful. But because of bad weather caused by Hurricane Agnes and a late crop, they're now very scarce. Food brokers say there is a real shortage. No one has to tell the housewife that prices have gone way up. Onions were selling for 19 cents a pound here a year ago. Today, they're 49 cents a pound, and most shoppers are not buying them. The high price of onions has already had its effect here in Detroit. The Coney Island hot dog is a tradition here, much like the crepe in Paris, the corn on the cob in Tokyo, or the soft pretzel in Philadelphia. For those unfamiliar with Detroit Coney Islands, they're hot dogs with chili, mustard, and onions on them. They're nothing like the hot dogs with sauerkraut you buy at Coney Island in New York. But the owners here say the price of onions is now too high, and rather than raise the price of their conies, they've cut out the onions, and they've gotten a mixed reaction from their customers.
How do you feel about the Coney Island without onions?
They're not really that bad. It's just like indigestion without heartburn.
No way, no. They could do better to take away the hot dog and put the chili in the onions, honestly.
For an onion fan, the conies are just not the same anymore. But they can take heart because in several months, there'll be another onion crop, and then prices are expected to come down. Lou Davis, NBC News, Detroit.
Soviet Communist Party leader Leonid Brezhnev met for 3.5 hours in Moscow today with 7 visiting American senators. They talked about trade and the Soviet-American trade bill now before Congress. The biggest trade deal ever between the two countries was last year's billion-dollar American grain sale. That came about because of a poor Soviet harvest in 1972. Robert Hager reports on prospects for the 1973 harvest.
Spring has come to the heart of the Russian grain-growing region, and with it a huge government effort to recover from last year's drought and poor harvest. This is the 60,000-acre Malchevsky State Farm in the North Caucasus. It's on the edge of the Russian steppe and what's called the Black Soil Belt. People here, as elsewhere, had to scrimp through the winter. Vegetables and potatoes were sometimes short. Bread was not short, but only because Russia bought 35 million tons of wheat and other grains from the West. Sheep and cattle had to be fed less grain than usual. There simply wasn't enough to go around. Now, the first of this year's grain crop is already starting to appear, so-called winter wheat planted last fall. It was a mild winter, and agronomists say the crop looks good, but there simply isn't enough of it. Because it was so dry last fall, thousands of acres had to be left unplanted. To catch up, there's a huge effort to sow more seed than normal this spring. New and higher targets have been set for farm workers. Equipment deliveries have been speeded up after government criticism of an inefficient supply system. The Malchevsky farm got a dozen new tractors this year and 18 new seed spreaders. The farm also got 500 extra tons of chemical fertilizers, twice as much as the year before. Every available square foot is being plowed for grain. This strip alongside a dirt road is being used for the first time. Now, much depends on the weather. Even at best, Soviet weather can be difficult. Already seasonal winds have started to blow here, and in another month, this rich soil may turn to dust. Undoubtedly, the Soviet Union will have to turn to the West again for at least some grain. But the worst of the problem seems to be over. As long as the weather isn't too bad, this year's purchase may not be nearly so big as last. Robert Hager, NBC News in the North Caucasus.
Bernadette Devlin, the young Catholic leader from Northern Ireland and a member of the British Parliament, got married today. She's 26 years old. Her bridegroom is a 24-year-old schoolteacher. The stock market opened the week badly today. Trading was light and prices fell sharply. The Dow Jones Industrials were down almost 8 points. On the New York Exchange, the average price of a share fell 21 cents. On the American Exchange, the average price of a share lost 7 cents.
RC Cola's got the taste that's right for you.
RC Cola.
It's not too heavy, not too sweet. It's right for you.
RC Cola.
If what you do is right for you, no matter what the others do, then RC Cola is right for you.
RC, tastes not too heavy, not too sweet.
The big grass machine, lawn boys mowing machine. The big grass machine, solid state mowing machine. Starts so quick and sure, like no other one. Gets you off your back and out in the fun. The big grass machine.
Finally tonight, a special report from Jack Perkins about Jonathan Livingston Seagull. In case you didn't know, that's a short book about an upwardly mobile seagull. 5 million people have bought the book, and a lot of them apparently liked it. Others found it a bore, or worse. In any case, J.L. Seagull is something of an industry. A movie's being made. The book is being debated in churches and schools. It's been banned in one California town. If you read the book, maybe you'll like this film Jack Perkins has produced.
A seagull that talks. Unlikely bestseller. So why is Jonathan Livingston Seagull happening? I guess to answer the question, you might ask psychologists or publishers or theologians. Or you might visit a field somewhere in Central Florida and see an airplane mechanic. Maybe for this purpose, talking to him is the next best thing to talking to a seagull.
And that should give me another 100 RPM.
He introduces himself as Slim Ptarmigan with a P. In fact, though most of the neighbors around here don't know it yet, Slim Ptarmigan's real name is Richard Bach, and he's the man who wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull. Indeed, if Richard Bach weren't so busy being Slim Ptarmigan...
That's too much RPM.
He might be Jonathan Seagull. At least, he and Jonathan share their one great love. That is flying.
If religion can be defined as a way of finding what is true, then flying is a religion, because you have to trust what you can't see in order to fly an airplane, right? I could identify very much with Jonathan. I like the little critter. I knew how he felt when he was doing that flying. That first time, he said, okay, here I go. I'm gonna do this thing. Are you ready, world?
Jonathan Seagull, in the book, loves to fly and learns to fly as no one could have imagined. Well, the book sells the same way.
You project the date out, and I saw that about April of 1974, the planet would be covered about 7 feet deep in copies of Jonathan Seagull. When he came out, for instance, I think it's the only book in history that has been on the bestseller list, both of fiction in the New York Times and nonfiction in Publishers Weekly, which is quite a comment about the kind of people who report books, because in a way, well, it's a talking seagull, therefore it must be fiction, but Jonathan's also talking spiritually about things that are quite true, so it's nonfiction in that light.
Psychologists say Jonathan Seagull is popular because it offers the reader what Jung called compensations. Publishers say it's because it's a simple, short book. Theologians say because the philosophy is obviously Christian, or clearly Zen, or certainly Hindu. Everyone has an answer.
Why is he popular? Jonathan is popular, I think, because we are popular with ourselves. There's that inner part of us that lives for the moments of excellence that we touch. That's Jonathan. And we see it all too rarely in our lives. And so Jonathan is another moment. Jonathan is a mirror for that part of us that we know is divine. Well, someone said Jonathan is a story of Jesus the Christ, which startled me until I realized, sure, that's true. But Jonathan is also the story of Charles Lindbergh and Christopher Columbus and Jacques Cousteau and Martin Luther King and anyone who has found his love and followed it, period.
Why is Jonathan Seagull happening? I guess all we can say is that an airplane mechanic in Central Florida thinks he at least learned something from Jonathan.
I'm glad I had a chance to meet him.
Good night for NBC News.